Welcome back to TBR and welcome to a bustling Saw Running HQ this Thursday just past. As part of the brand's partnership with the London Design Festival, they were hosting a panel. Entitled Running a Creative Approach, the discussion explored how creativity and design manifest in and shape all areas of running, and yours truly had the honour of hosting. Joining me was Saw founder Tim Saw, architect and writer Sarah Ackland, Olympian and founder of the running channel Andy Badley, and head of marketing for Soho House and founder of Hot Boys, Kamiko Ninomiya. Let's hand over to me, then. So good evening, everyone. Welcome to Saw HQ. My name is Danny Easton. I'm the producer and host of the Big Run podcast and the Saw Long Form podcast. And I'm delighted to be here at Saw HQ with our fantastic panel guests to talk about design, creativity, and how it filters through the lens of running. I'm super keen as well for you all to be part of this conversation today as well. So there will be an opportunity at the end of the panel for you to put your questions to our panelists as well. So if something stands out, you want to dive deeper on something, or if I've missed something glaringly obvious, then there will be an opportunity at the end. This is in conjunction with London Design Festival, which has been going now for over 20 years and is a celebration of the capital's great creatives and designers. And I'm thrilled to be joined by four of them here as well. So I'm going to stop yapping and get our guests to introduce ourselves and introduce themselves, and then we'll get into the conversation. Tim, do you want to kick things off for us?
I'm Tim Saw, so welcome to my gaff.
My name's Kamiko. I am the head of marketing at Soho House. I'm also the founder of a women's running collective called Hot Boys, which there's some members here today.
I'm Sarah Ackland. I'm an architect at MAF Architecture Art, a PhD candidate, and that's about it.
Hi, I'm Andy Badley. I'm the co-founder of The Running Channel, and I used to be a professional athlete before working in media.
Fantastic, thank you. So, as a bit of a through line to this conversation, I thought we'd start with, in terms of design, the things closest to us, the things we wear on our bodies, and as we are, like you said, Tim, in your gaff, in your atelier, it feels right to start with you. I remember when I first interviewed you, actually, and I asked you where your love of design came from, and you said it was Airfix models, which I thought was which was lovely. Yes. I imagine when it comes to designing sort of solutions for runners that are fit for purpose, stylish, and for want of a better expression, runnable in, it's probably a bit more complicated when there isn't instructions, right?
Yeah. I don't want this to, you know, I think we all want to avoid this sounding like a kind of Instagram motivational talk about what is creativity. So I'm going to talk about what it means for me in the context of running clothing and running. And that might just be how it works for me, and it doesn't work like that for anyone else. But anyway, there you go. So for me, you know, the starting point about thinking creatively about running clothing is thinking about performance. And I remember I was interviewing for a design assistant a few years ago, and everyone came and showed me flat drawings, and I said, what have you made? You know, what garments have you made? How do they perform? How do they work? And nine times out of 10, there was no answer. It's like, well, look, I've done a designer's collection. So for me, creative thinking about a performance garment, a sportswear garment, starts with how it performs. Can you make it lighter? Can you make it warmer? Can you make it more breathable? Can you make it more waterproof? And that then informs the kind of creative process about how you get to an end product. So you start with a concept, you know, what am I trying to do? And that concept comes from a point of truth in a run. So all of the garments I've designed come from a point of truth in running. They're garments that I've thought about, I've wanted when I'm running. And therefore, you have to bring your prototyping process back into the context of a run. So the way we develop a garment here, and the creative process in developing a garment here, is you make a prototype, it might be right, it might be wrong, you go out and test it, and the creative part of that is understanding how a garment feels when you're running, and being able to project and make a projection and imagine how you could make it better for the next prototype, and how you can iterate it, and how you can make it perform better. And that is centered on running. So I'm absolutely adamant you cannot design sportswear if you don't do the sport. You can't design running clothing if you don't run in it. And I see and I've experienced much sportswear and running clothing where it's clear to me that the designers have not run in it to any significant degree. So that part of the creativity of the process is absolutely sort of totally linked to the process of running as well. You have to run in it, you have to experience it, you have to understand how it feels. So that's the first bit. And then the second bit is don't be afraid of mistakes. You know, for me, significant breakthroughs are often made in by mistakes. And that can be part of the sort of prototyping process, or it can be external mistakes. And that, again, part of your creative process has to be to allow in mistakes, and when those mistakes happen, to understand whether they're beneficial or they're destructive. And I'll give you an example of that, which you may know if you've seen the designer's notes. So our best-selling garment is a race vest. And you thought, well, a race vest is a race vest is a race vest, and we sell Head and Shoulders more race vests than any other garment in our collection. And I developed it, it had gone through a few generations, and it was a great garment, and the fabric was really good. And I took one on holiday to Mallorca, and it was going to be very hot, and I took a sample, and it was a wrong size, it was a small sample, and I wouldn't normally wear a size medium. And I went running in the race vest and thought, oh, it's a bit tight. Went running, and halfway through the run, was zoning out, and then sort of came back into the moment and thought, oh, I forgot to put my top on. And in fact, I was still wearing the vest, but with a tighter fit, it had become much more effective at managing sweat. And by being more effective at managing sweat, it made it much cooler, so it made it feel like you weren't wearing a garment. Now, that was a mistake. I wouldn't have designed that garment like that. But that was the last piece in the puzzle that made that garment really, really good. So, you know, it's really, really important, I think, if you're any creative person, that you have to allow and encourage mistakes into your process, because that's, otherwise, you don't make significant leaps, you make small incremental leaps. So, mistakes. And then the next bit is, you know, allowing for the fact you've got to allow mistakes in, and allowing for the fact you have to be in the, you know, you have to prototype things and you have to experience from the truth of the run. You have to be egotistical enough to, or I have to be egotistical enough to trust that your idea is a good idea. And it maybe it's a crap idea or maybe it's a great idea, but you're never going to find out unless you go out and do it and trial it and test it. So you have to embrace your ego in the creative process as well. And if you don't, I don't think you can be truly creative, because otherwise, what view are you taking? And another example of that, which is coming from the point of truth in a run, when I wasn't doing track sessions, when I was running by myself, I was doing all my sessions on the towpath by the Olympic Stadium, Hackney Marshes. And normally, obviously, you do a session, you wear your tights, you change, put your shorts on if you're by the track. And I wasn't doing that. It was cold, it was winter, so I had to wear one pair of tights. And I had an epiphany as I was doing this session, was what I needed was a thin pair of tights that would be very stable and wouldn't move when you're running fast sessions, that you could do your warm-up and your session at the same time. And what that meant was a thin pair of tights. And that seems counterintuitive. Why are you producing a cold weather garment and making it thinner? And again, this has been our best-selling pair of tights. This product, which is thin, it allows a high degree of mobility, it allows you to run fast if you want to, is something that's a significant point of difference with what we do from what anyone else does. So I think, and that was, you know, pure ego saying, yes, this is a good idea, yes, I'm gonna do it, and yes, I've got the resources to execute that idea. So have real-world experience, allow for mistakes, have enough ego to believe that your ideas are at least worth trying out, and then the knowledge to know to filter out the crap ones from the good ones. And the last thing, and probably the most important, is rinse and repeat. You know, I think I'm very good at designing running clothing, and that's the ego part of me saying that, but I think it's true. And the reason I'm good at it is because I had 6 years running a high fashion business before that. And before that, I had 20 years working in music and graphic design, interior design. And so each bit of those creative practices has kind of accreted and built up and built up and built up and ended up a point at SOAR where you can pull all those different strands together in a single creative process. So you have to have that kind of bedrock of consistency, I think, and which of course is true in running, so to bring it back to running. So for me, those are the major principles of how you work with your creative process. And it's not, and it fucking is not, about doing a picture on a piece of paper and saying this looks great. That's not how you design sportswear.
There you go. No further questions, Your Honour. Well, succinct response. I'm curious though to go back to that thing you're talking about the ego and that sort of singular focus. Is there an element when you're working or gestating ideas within the SOAR where you bring it out to the team? Like, is there a sense of collaboration at all when you're sort of percolating particular ideas?
Okay, so there you go. There's another bit. Thank you, Danny. There's another bit of the creative process, which is you have to have enough ego to believe in your ideas, but you have to let go of your ego to build a creative team. And you have to let other people bring their ideas in, and you have to treat those ideas as respectfully as you treat your own ideas. And that can be a fine balance. You know, I think any creative person would say the point where you stop being an auteur, if you like, a single creative person, to working as part of a team, that can be quite a tricky transition. And I have a fantastic team now, and they're very creative and have great ideas, and it's a pleasure to let them in.
Is there also, as well, because obviously you're running a business here as well, when you have all of these ideas, is there an element of filtration of, I think this is a great idea, but do I think the running public is going to think this is a great idea as well?
Yes. Yes. But you shouldn't try to do that too much. You know, going back to the illustration of a thin pair of running tights, who'd have thought it? Who'd have think that's what the running public wants? Who'd have thought a tight race vest is what the running public wants? Mm. So you have to, and how you know that is you go back to the point of truth in running, and do you think it works really well when you're running? And if you think it works really well when you're running, someone else is probably going to think that as well.
Mm. Interesting, really interesting. Now, you're talking about running around the Olympic Park and just bringing this sort of discussion out a little bit to think about the sort of spaces we run through as runners. I'd love to throw to you, Sarah, as an architect,
yeah,
and as a runner. I mean, what does creativity mean to you as both those things?
I guess, so for me, I'm an architect practicing, but what we mostly do at Mark is public space design. And so being able to use my running in that means that when I actually, you know, take to the streets, I kind of understand how a site works by running through it. And I will run the sites that I'm working, you know, we do a lot of large outdoor public spaces, and go through them at various times of the day. And the thing is, you know, who's the most able body in a space? It's a white man. The secondary is the white running woman, as I am. And so by putting my most able body in a space, if I'm not acceptable there, then I can pick up what other inequalities might lie. And that then informs my design work, so that I can respond to those sort of design questions within the office. But also, you know, I can run through old designs and understand, because there's no point in designing something and not going back to it. Like this, any architect in the room, stage 7, like, go back.
What, stage 7?
Yeah, it's the end bit where you're okay. Supposed to go back and look at it and look at your failings. But no one likes to do it. But when you're running, you're sort of forced into it because you're like, oh, or you're forced into actually slagging off other people because you're like, oh, I know who did that, but that's actually really crap, I'm not going to do that. And it's like, you could spend 8 hours on the tube a week, you know, getting to work, whatever, but I choose to do that through running. And in that, it means that I've learned the city better, I sort of know how people like to use spaces a bit better. So also, you know, as much as it informs the design, it then also informs, so my PhD is, working title, haven't actually decided, but something about women in public space through the lens of a female runner. And essentially, it's, you know, by putting my space, my body in a space, and feeling how much space I can take up as the most able of the marginalised. If I can't take up that space, and we all know as women runners, you know, the minute darkness falls, half the city becomes out of bounds to us. Then what are the problems there? And sadly, as far as design solutions go, I think, you know, I started this PhD in 2020 and people were like, oh, but it's so much better now, right? Like everything, you know, spaces, where can you not run? Like, please, the canal? Like, oh. And then Sarah Everard happened and Aisling Murphy, sadly, who was murdered on a run. And people started to go, oh, that's quite interesting. So more streetlights, right? Yeah, more streetlights. Mm. And it's like, it's not that simple. And as I was saying to you, I don't exactly have any conclusions quite yet, but I think what is important is that by running, we can start testing spaces and understand where us as the most able of society can understand where inequalities do exist and try and break those barriers down for other people. And so that's sort of what running and creativity means to me. Is as a designer, I can be a better and more meaningful and impactful designer, but also researcher by using my body in a space.
Mm. I'm not going to ask you to give your PhD in terms of...
That's what I told you not to.
I'm interested because, you know, Tim touched on it as well, that the sort of testing process, and you were saying about testing is running through spaces, mm-hmm. like, what does that actually look like, and what are the sort of cues you're looking for as you run through those spaces of like, oh, maybe I could do this better, or maybe I could look at that?
I mean, I really don't have a very methodical method. Right. I've done filming, I've done voice recording, which is quite interesting because you do get all the catcalls. Iona and I were out this morning and we were talking about this.
Yeah.
Are there still catcalls?
Yeah, so we were literally running along.
We were talking about this panel this morning.
Yeah.
The gun.
Yeah,
really?
This exact topic, and then three guys walking along the street catcalled us.
And were you recording as well at the same time?
No, I wasn't. Oh, okay. I was like, you literally couldn't catcall.
We can F bomb here.
Can you? I was like, you just couldn't write it. Like, it was so timely, wasn't it? And so yes, it does still happen. I think it is still a barrier to. And in one way, I don't want to talk about it too much because I don't want to put anyone off. But then also, I think everyone here probably has an interest in running and does run. So it's still a really prolific issue. And you know, there's lots of methods that you can record it, but ultimately, what I experience is as an intersection of my body and who I am and where I am. Everyone's going to experience it differently. So I can only record from the body that I'm in. Mm. And that's sort of where I've drawn conclusions from. But what I can see is what I am battling with. And I would say I am in a privileged body, and therefore, if I am battling with certain things, then I definitely can see how that can be better, and whether that's a more direct route, drop curves are like massively. I actually got my job at Muff replying to an advert that said, can you draw a curb? So I just sent curb drawings. That in public space, all you do is draw curbs. I know. It's boring.
I'm just trying to picture this.
But you have to get it right.
Why is that detail? They say design is in the details. Like, why is that detail such a game changer for you?
Access is in the detail.
Okay.
Talk to me a little bit about Muff as well. Something I was really interested in.
Muff, I mean, I'm just an architect there. I've been there for 4 years. But they were established in 1995 by I don't know how many people started it. Women! Women architects. At the time, there were no female-owned firms. Matrix, a feminist design collective, had operated since the 80s. They were sort of closing down as Muff started up. So there's actually a lecture called From Matrix to Muff. And they're now sort of 25 years old. The directors are so experienced, but we are always at least 80% female. We're actually 100% female at the moment. And known for working with people, maybe not even coming up with a design solution, but there's many phrases that we use at Muff, but one of them being access is a gorgeous norm, rather than a privilege.
I love that sentiment, gorgeous norm, thank you. Just shifting outwards then, I think there's a lot to sort of take from that, a lot to percolate, but you know, we've talked about the clothes that we wear on our bodies, the spaces that we move through, and then there's the stories that we tell in those spaces as well. And before we did this panel discussion, we actually sent a bit of a prompt to each of the guests asking them what creativity in running meant to them. And for you, Andy, it was storytelling. Mm. Was there a reason that you chose that when you think about creativity in running?
It's related to both the speakers so far in that it's accessibility. So we set out at the Running Channel to do something that wasn't happening in the running space in terms of something that was for everybody who runs. That was telling stories about running. The stories weren't told through a kind of Instagram filter of like how amazing running is all of the time. Mm. And it also wasn't just told about one type of runner. So everyone has a really different running experience, whether they're running their first 5K or they're chasing their 10th, 6th or 10th star marathon major, whatever it might be. And we wanted to try to have people on the channel that kind of, so I'm from a professional sports background in terms of running. And we set up the channel, and the idea, so I do present on the channel now, but not that often because I'm probably not the most relatable, because my experience is through elite sport. I've had access to all sorts of stuff most runners don't get access to, physiologists, psychologists, but I can use that expertise to hopefully help other people enjoy running in the way that I have. Mm. And then also, running was my job, so actually by the end of it, I hated it. because I had to run 12, I was running 12 times a week, 100 miles a week. And I had to go out, otherwise I didn't get paid. So it became this thing that I was good at and enjoyed, so it became a career, and that's really exciting. And then by the end of it, you're sort of, it came down to 3 or 4 minutes a year for me as to whether I get paid next year. Mm-hmm. So, and if you wake up that morning and don't feel very well, then that's not great. So there's a lot of pressure. But then now, running has come full circle for me, so running is my creative space because I'm working, I have a family, so getting out on a run is actually probably, I'm not the world's most creative person, but on a run, that's where I have the good ideas. As long as, I'm sure people can relate in this room, as long as I can remember those ideas by the time I get back. Quite often in the first 5 or 10 minutes of my run, I'm like, oh my God, yeah, this is the great. Oh, and then I get back at the end of my run, and I've got no idea what it was, because I've probably spent the last 10 minutes of my run thinking about what I'm going to call it on Strava. that's ultimately accessibility through relatability, telling stories about people running marathons for charity, coming back to running 10K after 3 years of serious injury and knee surgeries. And then as part of that, I suppose my journey to what I do now is through lots of different, a little bit like Tim said, having different skill sets that have then come into what you're doing now. So I grew up sketching running shoes, because that's what I wanted to do, was design running shoes. Mm. Then I did an engineering degree, and then I became a professional runner when I was the sports marketing person that got access to the design teams for the brand that I might have been representing. And then now I sometimes get to test the products. So as part of what we do tell stories, but we also test the products. And then often we'll tell stories through the lens of a brand and what they're trying to achieve. But trying to keep almost like what the brand wants out of it, and just trying to keep it like a real story.
You touched on it then, because you've got a first in engineering as well?
Yeah, a long time ago.
So you know your design. I'm curious about those two strands of the storytelling strand and your design background. What's the sort of marriage between the two when you're thinking about a narrative that's going to communicate with an audience, but how much are you designing that, of also thinking this is going to have traction and do good views?
Yeah, another parallel is mistakes. Like actually often you'll labour over a video for weeks and put that one out and we get immediate feedback on YouTube or social media where like you can see if you've got the title wrong, the thumbnail wrong, or you've got the first 30 seconds wrong, then the video just dives and you can't get it back. Mm. Conversely, there'll be videos where we've shot and edited it in a day and put it out, maybe because actually someone messed something up and we wanted to hit a published schedule, we put that out. And that one takes off. And then you're like, what did we do in that? And maybe that's actually a lesson. Like, actually, the more polished it is, sometimes the less real it feels. So when it's a bit more rushed out the door and you don't worry so much about the graphics or the like beautiful transitions or whatever it might be, then people are like, that feels like me. When we tell stories that are, it's hard to get out sometimes, like it's wet. You don't want to go for a run. When we tell those stories, and I think everyone can be like, yeah, I feel like that too. And rather than try and paint a 16-week marathon picture as like, I just got better every week, I ran a marathon, it was easy, job done.
And what about, because we were talking about this before we got up here, you've recently gone through a rebrand for the channel as well.
Yeah.
What was that process like for you, sort of thinking about visual identity?
Yeah, and what that visual identity means to the people, because we have probably two customers. We have the main customer, which is the people that are watching the videos that we make and that think of us as, we like to position ourselves, I suppose, as people talking about running in the pub that you quite like. So it's not supposed to be elitist or that we're massive experts. We just know a little bit more and talk about it in a way that hopefully allows people to learn about it. So then how do you put that into a logo or into colours? And how do you do that in a way that... our first logo was very simple, the Running Channel, and there was a pair of feet in the U making the kind of... And that was like 50 quid with a friend that did it because we were just starting out. And then people were attached to that. So also you don't want to piss people off that have like grown up with or you know come with you on the journey from the beginning. And then I was fighting stakeholders who wanted something really literal. So they want shoes or feet in the logo, and I'm fighting really hard against that. And so what I ended up with is broadly it's a slightly rotated asterisk. Being that an asterisk is what you go to for a footnote. It's like it's where you go to for more information, and that's what you want to be someone's running friend, where we're supporting them. And also it looks like it's kind of rotating forward, so there's an element of movement to it. We wanted to have a totally new visual identity. And then all of the thought that goes into it, like, oh, it's 10 degrees rotated this way, and all of that. No one else would ever care about that, but I care about it.
Feel free to put those questions to Andy as he mills around. I'd be remiss if I didn't. I'd love to just touch briefly on your life as obviously an elite level athlete, double Olympian, wildly impressive. The creative side of that, because you put a video out recently that was reflecting on your kind of pre-race preparation when you're an elite athlete to you doing your pre-race preparation for was it a 5K, I think?
Yeah, I did a 5K. That was an incredible race to go. I went out to Monza to do a race around the F1 circuit, which was really cool. But it was the first race that I was trying to win since like retiring. Mm. And we're making a video, which doesn't make it easier. Thankfully, it won't make me talk while I was running.
Were there any other creative elements in your professional life as an elite athlete? Were there any things that you designed, like pre-race rituals or anything like that, like that felt kind of creative, or was it much more kind of...
No, I don't think I could claim any of that. I was very regimented with like trying to stick to a routine. I did have design input into shoes. So I actually have my own pair of shoes back in 2011 maybe. Mm-hmm. And that actually went to market with my name on it, which is really cool. And that was like this realization of a childhood dream where I've been drawing these shoes in my bedroom age like 11. Mm-hmm. And then they asked me like as an athlete sponsor, would you like this? I was like, yes, I would like this. bumping into random people, like there's a running famous running store on the finish line of the Boston Marathon. And they have a pair of them up like I think I signed them years ago. And then I met someone in a lift once in LA or somewhere, and they were wearing them. And I was with a friend, and it was really the worst possible example because I was with a friend who then was like, do you know what they are? And the person was like, no, I don't even run. So, but yeah, I think they picked them up because they were clearly like massively discounted. They hadn't shifted any units, so just
fine. Oh, gosh, it stings. Thank you, Andy. Kimiko, I'd love to move over to you to talk about community, because I feel like community flows through everything that we've talked about today. And when you sent in your response to that initial prompt, you said that creativity is the through line to your running practice, and I love that sentiment. Do you want to unpack that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you think about running, when you think about training programs, it can all feel very regimented. And kind of just to give a little bit of background where I come from in like my running community, I was part of a crew in New York where the motto and kind of what I brought here to Hot Boys is running on feel. So it's less about like, we're running these specific paces, we're doing this time, like hitting the mark. It's more about feeling your body and what you're capable of in that moment. And I think that's specifically is very important to women who have a cycle and feel different ways throughout a month. And you kind of just have to be able to understand and really tune into your own physical body. So from that respect, I think it's like, it actually is a practice. And I think often what people forget about is running and training is a practice, and there's a play element in that. So I like to bring that to kind of Hot Boys and everything that we're doing. But then in addition to that, with starting a running group, I think there's also been some more maybe traditional creative elements, which is like coming up with a brand, thinking about what the purpose of the group is and how that is represented visually, and how that represents people in the group as well as myself.
What were some of the processes behind the sort of visual identity of Hot Boys? Because it does have like a unique kind of visual. Was there like inspiration, or was it more organic?
You know, So it kind of started with the name, which was meant to be a bit cheeky and maybe a bit of a something towards what I view as the running community at large, which is very male-dominated and women taking up space. And then, I don't know, I felt, so it was like the cheeky element, but then how do you make that, how does that kind of, how do you contradict that visually where it's maybe more collegiate and something that's closer to like the, like a club level kind of design. And so mixing the two of those things together. And then we always try to, I always try to bring in like some sort of cheeky element, whether it's like an emoji or like something, it's kind of like a wink and a nod, like fun element that, yeah.
Well, is it important to have that playful element, do you think?
Well, I mean, it goes back to kind of how I think about training and where it is a practice and like bringing play into that and really making it like a collaborative space for yourself.
And is it also an area for you, Susan? I know you mentioned this, Sarah, as well in your response about to connect with other creatives as well. Have you found that within your kind of community that there's other creatives within it that give you kind of inspiration and ideas?
So, I think the group has grown to a point where I think when I started it, I had an idea of what I wanted to create. I wanted to welcome in people to a space that felt supportive from a running perspective, but what it's also brought in is people from different backgrounds, who some of them are from creative backgrounds, some of them are not. And I think that the blend of that together is really inspirational and also brings like an interesting perspective to running as a sport.
And many people within your group, are they doing marathons at the moment? Are people being off to Berlin or Chicago within your alumni?
So we have one running Berlin who's in the room.
In the room? Oh. Good luck. I don't know where you are, but good luck.
And then a couple of us are running in Chicago, and then a big crew are running Valencia in December, which is really exciting, and I can't wait to see.
Okay, well, you'll be showing up in your hot boys regalia.
Yeah, I'll be there.
Amazing. I'm conscious that I've been sort of firing a lot of questions at you, but do you have any questions for each other? I feel like it would be a missed opportunity if we didn't sort of pull this collective creative design experience.
I've got one, and it's an observation more than a question, which is, since COVID, so I run on Hackney Marshes a lot, which I went running there a lot with my wife before lockdown, and she always said she felt, and for me as a man, it feels like a fantastic, open, relaxing, brilliant space. And my wife said, well, I wouldn't really want to run there by myself, but I'm very happy to run with you. And since COVID, I've noticed more and more single women runners there, which has been fantastic and really encouraging. That it's, you know, clearly people feel it's a safe enough space for them to go running and do their thing and not have to run in a group if they don't want to, and they're happy to run by themselves. So that to me seems positive change.
I would say that that's not necessarily what I experience or what I hear from women that I run with, but it's interesting that you're seeing that. I think for me, especially at the period of time when like Sarah Everard and everything was going on, there were some things going on in the marshes that made me feel very unsafe, and it's taken some time for me to feel comfortable running
so
in those spaces
again.
Interesting.
Yeah. There's definitely more numbers, but that's interesting about, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know how
because there was the incidents, I actually can't remember when it was, but there was a man on the marshes.
It was in all the WhatsApp groups.
And in a sense, I was like, I come from an abuse background, and I'm like, can you stop? Like, I feel I can't go out. Mm. But I think that the politics and the new, like, our bodies are only as free as the politics of the time. When I do think what's happened in the past 3 years with Black Lives Matter, Sarah Everard, like beyond just women's issues, has made people feel really conscious of who they are in a space. And in times, like you say, like you see more women running, I think, oh, it's getting better. And then other times I think, oh, it's not, because then you have this weird man who keeps, I don't know what was going on in the marshes. And then every time I go down the marshes, it comes to mind. And I run these events called Taking Space, and there's one coming up.
Use it, come on.
It was interesting that I held one in Newcastle, which is where I study, and women were telling me where they were scared because of what they knew happened there.
Sure, yeah.
So there's also what your body feels, what you feel about a space, how you're reacting, and maybe that is, in like my case, that might be because of my history, or it might be because you actually just feel that way, or whatever. Because some people will say to me, I just don't get what you're on about, I don't feel that way, and I'm like, you're so lucky. Like, please, I hope you stay like that forever. But in another sense, it's, you know, what we're told. And so even if a space is safe, if you know something did, like it did happen there, then it's sort of ingrained into the memory.
Yeah, it's always in the background.
Yeah,
sure.
And I don't think any amount of design can remove that
certainly.
When's the event that you're doing?
I don't know yet.
You don't know.
We're playing with a day.
Okay, a date may be available. Do you have any other questions for each other?
Just an observation related to that, or a question, I suppose, is that I only realised the privilege that I'd experienced a few years ago during that same period, where I still don't ever run with my phone, and I never thought anything of it. Mm. And you sort of flippantly were like, take a voice note when you go out running, but I don't have anything to do that with.
Yeah.
But I sort of, the question, I guess, is I assume that you would never run without a phone.
That's correct. I think I was doing some fit testing for SOAR, and I was like, women have to be able to carry their
phone. Pocket. Yes,
like,
sharing location.
We've had that message a lot,
like,
all the time, for sure.
I also felt really annoyed with Apple. You know, in that period where, this is me being incredibly cheap, when your phone would not stand its charge for the whole night. So you charge it at work till the minute you left, and then you put it in your pocket. You wouldn't use it until you had to get home. And it's, I felt annoyed with Apple because it's like my iPhone is my safety. It's how I get home. But also, now that they've stopped doing that annoying thing where they run your charger out so you have to buy a new one, I'll share my location with my sister until I get home. And that's the same on a run. And it's just, I just think it's these extra layers that we think, oh, well, everybody does that. But actually, everyone who is a woman does that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does anyone here have any questions for these panellists, please? This, your opportunity to take advantage of this incredible selection of guests. Any questions at all? Anyone at all? Yes, sir. Yes.
Hi, this is to Lucas and Andy. As people who have created very successful digital platforms, brands, if you were giving advice to anyone who was starting out, what would be your,
let's call it
architectural phase 7.
Love it.
Do you want to go, actually? Like? Okay. I hate phase 7. We have to do that in when we, that would be, I guess, us looking at all the data in the comments and stuff on the video, which is a scary place in the YouTube comment section.
Yeah.
Actually, interestingly, more scary probably, we see that inequality in the comments for a female presenter versus any of our male presenters. Mm. It's a tiny, tiny percentage, but they're the ones you remember, aren't they?
They're a bit misogynist.
Yeah. It's not always misogyny, there is some of that, don't get me wrong, but it's just weirdness. And also people love being first. They'll just comment first. Look at loads of YouTube videos, if you can find it, there'll
just
be someone
the word
first.
Wow.
God, I hope I'm that popular sometime.
Yeah, sorry, I'm not answering, this is me stalling for time while I think of something sensible to say. I think that the best piece of advice would be to press publish. So I'm definitely someone who needed someone sort of more entrepreneurial alongside me to not overthink it and try and get it to be perfect before I put something out in the world. We were pretty clear on our principles, like that I outlined, like we want to be relatable, want it all to be real, we don't want to patronise. So we had that. We just tried to strike that tone of voice. And so probably what I would do more quickly is that in YouTube or social media, I guess you were reliant on the algorithm to build that digital community. So you can't do anything until you've got data. So you can't do it. And so we do a podcast now, which I love. It's my favorite thing. But I sat on that for way too long before because I didn't know what the format was going to be. I wanted it to be perfect before I launched it. And so I think it's press publish. Like get the stuff out there. As long as you feel like it's true to the values of the product or community or the thing that you're trying to build, the people you're trying to talk to, then there's not too much to, like, the risk of some kind of catastrophic failure when no one knows who you are and haven't done anything is really low. So actually getting more stuff out there and getting the data back. Because if you just get, even if it's only 20 views instead of 5 views on one video, then you know that one's better, or that something about it is better. And then keep testing. So like, we change thumbnails, we change titles. Like newspapers have, to my knowledge, have dedicated SEO people that will regularly change the headlines of their articles every few hours, and then they'll A/B test those headlines. So a good example, sorry, I'm going off one a little bit. A good example that I use with my team is if you look at the BBC News app versus, say, the Apple News app. BBC News is kind of following Apple now, but certainly a year ago, BBC News app was very, like, all of the headlines are quite sensible, and like, this is what the article is, because they don't have to be sensationalist. If you've chosen to look at BBC News app, then you're just going to read what the news is. Apple News, it's all of the different publications competing for you to click on it, which is what social media and community building is. You're competing for everyone's attention. So, I guess, yeah.
So just to kind of riff on that, and I don't know if you're talking about Soho House or Hot Boys, but I'd say, like, in both cases, from a digital marketing perspective, you hear this kind of a lot, but done is better than perfect. And I'm very much a perfectionist, and it's better to just kind of, I think, trust your gut, get something out into the world, and you can kind of test and iterate as you go. And you will get that feedback and kind of understand what needs to change or what doesn't need to change, or whether you don't care if it, like, what the response is. But yeah, just kind of getting it out there, because I know that I struggle with as well, just kind of like getting things done. And it's when I'm in a time crunch and I'm like forced to make a decision when I think like maybe the best decisions are made, but yeah.
Yeah, just the final point, I think, is that you do lavish a lot of attention on the perfectionism. Like I said, sometimes you can make something really beautiful. And quite often I'm speaking to brands, I'm like, stop making beautiful content that nobody sees. Mm-hmm. Because if they don't, if you don't get the, in talking specifically about YouTube, I suppose. But I think the same would apply for the first couple of seconds on TikTok, for example. But if the thumbnail and the title's not right, no one's gonna watch it. So you could spend months on an incredible documentary or whatever. But if you haven't thought about why someone's gonna click on it, and then delivered on that click in the first 30 seconds, then the algorithm's gonna punish you, and it's gonna kind of die a death.
Super interesting. Any other questions? Yes.
I've got a question for Tim. How vigorously do you test your products? Like, how do you know when it's met the point where it's ready to be kind of given to the market? Obviously, like, you can carry on running for kilometers and kilometers and kilometers, but when do you know when it's time to start?
Yeah, it's a good question. So you have, you know, unlike doing a YouTube program where you have, it's out there, and then you repeat it, you do another one. When you press go on a product, you have a minimum of 300 units, maybe more than that. So it's a significant amount of stock, and it's a significant amount of cash tied up. So actually that is quite a pressured decision when you decide to let go of a garment. I test a lot, and you know, everyone else in the business tests a lot. And you know, the longer, the more mature the business has become, the more the testing team has grown. So you have to be comfortable with it, and sometimes that comes very quickly, and sometimes it comes very slow. The graphene vest upstairs was 3 years just to develop the vest, because it was never quite right, and it was, you know, that was a flagship product, so it didn't seem right to take it to market without it being very mature. Other products you can be a bit looser with. So it very much depends what the product is, but with this, you know, with the bank manager in the back of the mind going, are you sure you want to make 300 of those right now? Are they really, really ready?
Anyone else?
Yeah. For Sarah, from the lens of an architect, but also from the lens of a woman as well, what would you identify as, like, the maybe infrastructural design flaws that you might see when you're, like, running to work, running from work? You were talking earlier about people saying, like, you just put more like street lights.
Yeah.
But if there was a few things that you would change or implement about the kind of like design structure of like how stuff is built in general, what would you change?
I think it is very nuanced, which is why this answer is so hard to give. But there is evidence behind streetlights. But if it was that easy, they would have just put those more streetlights in. It doesn't negate the problem. There is evidence behind wider pavements, which I do think is a very productive thing. I think COVID actually really kind of gave people a realization why the pedestrian is so important. But I mean, in curves. It's so boring. But there is as far as like serious methods of design, I think the best way to make a difference in the space is to really to get to know the stakeholders, and that's not the client, because you might meet with the council or you might meet with the developer and they'll tell you one thing, but you need to go and intensely hang out in that space, and that's like a muff phrase. You go there and you hang out and you work out who actually uses that space and what their limitations are, and you go and find who can't use that space and why. Because we've been in spaces and we're like, there are no teenagers, and then we realise they've all got antisocial behaviour orders, and so then we've gone and found them when they're allowed out and find out why they're not hanging out there other than the fact they've got antisocial behaviour orders and why they got them and what that space might have created for them. And I think it's really about investing in stage 7 but also stage 1. How much fee do you put into stage 1? So little. Because you're like, oh yeah, briefing, yeah, it's fine, they've written us a brief. But their briefs are shit. Like, actually you need to get on the ground and find out what's going on. Actually, one other thing that is a real design, like proven design thing, which they've done really well in my opinion in Shoreditch Park, is removing fences and having more exits. So if you are in a space and you feel unsafe, you can get out.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Yeah, you have another one. Do you want to? Yeah.
You go. Just on a question for Tim. You were talking about ego earlier, and you were talking about all the design processes that you go through with products. Have there been any sort of standout moments along the whole like process of like Saw where you've had to drop your ego, and how do you cope with, how do you handle dropping your ego, especially as the founder of the brand as well? That must be it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so that's probably the most profound lesson I've learned in the brand. So all my other businesses were very top down. It's me saying, this is what I want. So it's either me working by myself or it was small teams, me saying, this is what I think it is. And what has to happen if you want to grow a business and you want to grow a team and you want to do more work and have more output, is, as I said, you have to let your ego down and you have to let other people have their space and allow other people their space to do what they do. And that's hard. You know, I think probably one is, you know, I'm not sure if this is exclusively true, all I can speak about myself. As a creative person, I'm quite egotistical. I think I've got a good idea, and maybe it is or maybe it isn't a good idea, but at least I think I've got a good idea. So that process is, as I said, quite egotistical. But that limit, if you just stick with that, that limits how big you can grow, what you can, you know, what the output of a team can be. So you have to let in the team, and that's not just letting in the creative team, letting them have their space to do their creative process, but it's about how you run your business. You have to let other people in the team to run that business. So, you know, I've got my name by the door, but if I was knocked down by a car, this business would probably run very well without me. So it's a painful lesson, and that was hard for me to learn. And I got very, and I dealt with it probably in quite an immature manner initially, frankly. But you have to do it. You have to, you know, it's part of growing up. You have to release your ego and let other people in.
Final question. Do you want to close this out?
It's a lot of pressure. I was going to say, I think that's pretty clear that running is very much like a community-driven thing. As a very, I would say, eclectic group of panelists, all with respective different communities, what would each of you say is the most important thing that you're trying to foster within really different communities?
It's the feeling that a lot of people run but don't think of themselves as runners. So that distinction is something we're trying to kind of battle, and therefore we want anyone who runs to feel welcome. So I suppose that's the single biggest thing, is that if you run, then there's something on what we're doing that is for you. So you could be the best runner, loads of experience competing at a really high level, but hopefully you'll be entertained or resonate kind of going through the same journey as other people on the channel. Or you could be brand new to running and think, oh, these are people I want to like spend some time with. So yeah, people feeling welcome, I think.
Responsibility, equality, and awareness, I think, from what I've sort of said. We're really lucky to be able to run. Running is a privilege. If you can take up the space of running, then we need to think about the people who can't and why they can't, and share the joy that we get from running with those people, and just don't take it for granted, basically.
For me, I mean, first and foremost, it was creating a safe space for women, but it's, I think, what was different for me, it's the performance-based group. So the people who have joined, it's not necessarily about the fastest runners, and I think, like, bringing people in who maybe wouldn't have thought about running in this way and making it feel comfortable and welcoming and open to ask questions, whatever that may be, whether it's about running or just about life, like, it is a welcoming and safe space to practice and get better and to strive for whatever goals it is that you have in this crazy weird running thing that we do.
Running is so I came to sport late in life. I was a DJ with a drug problem, and I knew at 40, and I'd never done sport, and I'd never embraced any sort of dialogue with my body. You know, everything had been out of my head. And I knew at 40 I was going to be dead at 50 if I didn't get fit. And discovering the beauty of moving your body, and, you know, that can be running, and it's, you know, 100% it's running in my life. It can be other things as well, but discovering that beauty of moving your body, it was so exciting to me and such a revelation. So being able to do anything to share that is a fantastic thing.
Great final question. You smashed it. Really final closing points. That feels like a really lovely note to end our conversation on. Please do stay. There is drinks and a big, big block of cheese in the back. But please join me in thanking our panellists.
A big thank you to Saw for the opportunity to host, and to our incredible guests. If you want to find out more about them and the work that they do, there are some links in today's show notes. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you are enjoying the podcast. Please do leave us a review from wherever you get the episodes from. And I'll see you next time for a preview of the World Road Running Championships in Riga, next time on The Big Run.